Sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Today you're going to hear the third part of a conversation or a dialogue called 9/11 and the Global Community, conducted by four distinguished Canadian professors, Anthony Hall, Michael Kiefer, John McMurtry, and Graham McQueen, who spoke here last year at the Remember Building 7 conference at the University of Hartford. The conversation you're about to hear was given at the Center for Globalization Studies at the University of Lethbridge in Canada and was posted on YouTube on January 2009. The topics they'll be covering in this section of the discussion are degradation of international law after 9/11, along with Orwellian doublethink, continuity of government, and how governments project on their enemy what they are actually doing themselves in order to justify attacking the other country. So let's begin.
Now, another aspect of this war against legality has to do with the degradation of our domestic legal structures. One of the most flagrant recent examples is of the recent conviction of one of the boys, I think he was probably 15 when he was arrested in 2006, as a putative member of the Toronto 18 terrorist conspiracy, right? They were accused of wanting to do all kinds of astonishing things, behead Stephen Harper, attack the parliament buildings. It wasn't quite clear whether they wanted to attack the Ontario provincial parliament buildings or the ones in Ottawa, and why they thought they might find Stephen Harper in Queen's Park in Ontario is a bit of a mystery. They wanted to attack the CBC building, CSIS headquarters, you name it. Now, setting aside the fact that that group was created by a highly paid government mole, we know a great deal. I've written about this at some length. We know a great deal about this mole. He received payments of something like $377,000 for his services in basically taking men and boys out for what they no doubt, most of them, all of them perhaps, thought were paintballing expeditions or camping weekends, which he was assiduously representing to his RCMP handlers as terrorist training camps. They had a second mole who was paid $4.1 million taxpayers' dollars, agricultural engineer, whose job was to assist in constructing the appearance that this group intended to deploy fertilizer fuel oil bombs, ammonium nitrate fuel oil bombs of the kind used by Timothy McVeigh in the Oklahoma City bombing of 1995, thereby, of course, painting the group as homegrown terrorists in the McVeigh model. A third mole was paid an undisclosed sum. He's the one who apparently introduced the notion to one or more of this hapless group of using ammonium nitrate fuel oil bombs. In other words, you have evidence of a very elaborate structure of entrapment. Now, beyond that, when I say degradation of law, you have the conviction of one of these boys in an Ontario court in September of this year. What he actually did was to take part in camping weekends, which the government, the principal government witness, mole number one, who organized these events, said this boy had no inkling of any malign purpose to any of the events in which he took part. In other words, in terms of his intention, and this is under common law, mens rea, guilty mind, is an essential component for determining guilt in the case. There was no question that he had any guilty mind, any mens rea, at all, whatsoever, by the government's own witness. He was guilty of shoplifting because the government mole encouraged this boy. He said, the stuff we need for our camping expedition, we're not going to buy legally. Let's be adventurous. Let's get it illegally. You go shoplift, and he gave him effectively a shopping list. Now, I don't think any normal court in a normal time would find this boy guilty even of shoplifting. He might find the RCMP guilty of incitement to something or other, because that's what happened. Instead of which, you have the ludicrous spectacle of a boy whose life is permanently stained by the mark that he is a terrorist, and who may spend 10 years in jail for shoplifting. I'll give you another, just very quickly, another example that is perhaps equally bizarre. And this is of an American man, Carl Moskowitz Blaze, who was arrested by the Secret Service in 2000 for circulating what the Secret Service took to be offensive cartoons threatening harm to a man under the protection of the Secret Service, at that time Republican presidential hopeful, George W. Bush. He wasn't yet his party's selected candidate. He went to trial for these cartoons, which I've seen. They're not particularly good cartoons. They're not especially offensive. One of them is provokingly prophetic in relation to the events of 9/11, because it portrays Twin Towers being hit by an aircraft and says George Bush is responsible for this kind of thing. So it's in a strange way perceptive. In any case, he was put away for 5 years in an American prison for this and subjected to forced psychiatric treatment. On getting out of prison, he came to Canada to seek refuge here, in effect, hoping he would find a place where he could have the freedom to voice his opinions, however obnoxious they might be to many people. And he was picked up by the Canadian Immigration Service and has been in detention for 18 months. And the evidence that's being used to hold him in detention is evidence cooked up largely by the Secret Service, and it is demonstrably corrupt and dishonest. Now, there you have simply two examples. One could supply many more, which are, of course, public knowledge in a major way. The Meher Arar case, in which you have the Canadian intelligence services deliberately supplying information to torturing agents in foreign countries to whom our citizen has been renditioned with the knowledge and complicity of Canadian government agencies. In other words, we were complicit, quite clearly, and that's been acknowledged by the O'Connor report, we were complicit in the torture of Meher Arar, and equally so of several other people who have been renditioned in the same way. The case of Omar Khadr, the last one I'll mention, is perhaps still more grievous, of a 15-year-old accused of being a child soldier. There's very good evidence that he wasn't, that he was a child victim of American special forces, and that whoever threw the grenade that killed an American soldier, it wasn't in all likelihood him, and the Americans know it wasn't him. And our own government shamefully refuses to act to prevent the kangaroo court illegalities to which he has been exposed. And indeed, the previous Liberal government sent CSIS and foreign affairs officials down to Guantanamo Bay to interrogate him in defiance of international law, in defiance, therefore, of Canadian law. So we have a degradation of legality and an almost systematic pattern of law-breaking behavior on the part of our governments.
Yeah, so this idea of the Canadian dimension of the war on terror, you know, underneath this is the question, well, what exactly is Canada? Is Canada a sovereign country, or is Canada essentially a colony of the United States? Do we have real self-determination in our country, or are we simply a satellite of another power, culturally, economically, even now politically? And certainly Omar Khadr in Guantanamo Bay in Cuba is a symbol that Canada really isn't exercising its sovereign identity, its sovereign personality. So over the course of the election, you know, there was a good deal of exchange and ideas about what might we do to help politicize the apparent disparity between the official conspiracy theory and the available evidence. How can we bring this out? How can we engage the political system when there seems to be, you know, so much stonewalling of the mainstream media? We see it within the universities. We've talked about it within the universities. And even within our own political parties, the people who are supposed to represent us just don't want to talk about this subject. It gets to this taboo. So how do we engage our political institutions? Surely, for instance, the government of Canada 24 Canadians were killed in the Twin Towers. How many Canadians were killed in the Air India event, for instance? When Canadians are killed, no matter where they are killed in the world, don't we want our own officials to look into what happened? When an individual's killed in Mexico, a single individual, I recall a lot of reports about it. What a scandal, what a betrayal by our government that we don't have an investigation into those 24 Canadians who were killed and our own way of viewing it. And then, of course, we have the reality of Afghanistan, the fact that we've seen four times that many individuals killed in Afghanistan, Canadian individuals. And who can say how many Afghanis have been killed by Canadians? And we've talked about them being possibly tortured after they're picked up by Canadians and handed over to the puppet government of Karzai in Afghanistan. And then there is the dimension of NORAD and the reality that the airspace of North America, well, part our sovereignty theoretically extends to the airspace, and we are part of NORAD. And NORAD was a big part, the failures of NORAD was a big part of what happened on 9/11. So I'll put this idea out in this form, in this venue, that we need a Canadian investigation into the Canadian aspects of what happened. And the fact that it seems so hard to get that, you know, speaks to my way of thinking, a profound failure of our institutions, a kind of fraud that is imposed upon us that we have a kind of sovereign government or self-government when, you know, the four of us sitting around the room in around this table, for instance, we're not insignificant individuals. We're not alone. We understand in various public opinion surveys that a growing number of people, a large percentage of people, just don't really have confidence any longer in the official story of what took us in to the war on terror, what's taking us into this progressive loss of our civil liberties, the reality that we may already be in a structure of government, the continuity of government that Peter Dale Scott writes about, that there's already a constitutional transformation that has taken place on a secret level, and we're running according to some kind of emergency measures regime where people who are really in charge are not publicly accountable in any way. Is there other dimensions we can bring up about the Canadian in our own country, looking at this global situation, how we can read it as Canadians and affect change within our own constitutional framework, our own supposedly sovereign institutions?
Well, I think that the biggest problem really is the normalization of all this. It's just been normalized and internalized, not only by the media, but by ordinary people, and that in fact is the cool thing to be. That's the way it is. And just as our colleague said earlier on, that the people just don't really care, or cynical, whatever. It's just a normalization.
Can I add something? Sorry to interrupt. It's like you mentioned the media there. Like, I came in today and turned on CBC. So I get the picture. CBC is supposed to be a totem of Canadian society, and I call it the Conservative Broadcasting Center, you know, because of the supine propaganda which they indulge in. And, you know, they were talking about piracy and how the West's coming to save the day with pirates on the Horn of Africa. And it reminded me of, St. Augustine writes of how Alexander the Great encountered a pirate and said, "How dare you go around the waters stealing people's things and terrorizing the waters?" And the pirate replied, "Well, you do exactly the same, but they call you an emperor." And I mean, that really sums up the world we live in. And then to put the icing on the cake, they had the Saudi foreign minister, a man who represents a kleptocracy, as if he was some kind of ally, saying, we'll throw in soldiers to help with the war on piracy. And it was, and the irony was completely missed by the presenters, because, you know, the truth is they want slave governments, and they went into Afghanistan because the Taliban weren't willing to cooperate. They went into Iraq because Saddam stood up to the West. They'll never invade Egypt because Hosni Mubarak is a puppet. They'll never invade Saudi Arabia because the kleptocracy there is obedient. They killed Salvador Allende in Chile because he wasn't obedient. They staged coups against Hugo Chavez because he wasn't obedient. And that's the truth. And like you say, Canadian soldiers are going to be killed. And this word, the Taliban, I mean, how do we know they're the Taliban? I always say, you know, do they have a membership card in their pocket? I mean, they said this in the Vietnam War, didn't they? You know, saying, "Oh, the Viet Cong," and then we found out it was just villagers, you know? And it's the same with the Afghani people. I mean, the sad fact is, how do we know that the Taliban, when we murder them, massacre them with these, you know, grotesque weapons, and you know, it's all funded by the taxpayers, as is the CBC. I mean, it's unbelievable, really, isn't it? You know,
it is. Well said.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, the Taliban, one thing the Taliban did when they were in power in Afghanistan is they cut the drug trade considerably. So since the Northern Alliance was backed by the United States to take power, essentially we have a government of drug lords. And there's been an enormous increase in the export of opium or heroin out of Afghanistan.
Thanks for your speech. I really like the way you explained Canada's role in the fight on terrorism. They said they broke international rules of laws and all that. There is this course I took last semester. It was on, defining terrorism. So many people defining terrorism. We just had to go through them like a big book, different definitions. And the main thing was trying to define what is terrorism. So my main point is Canada would be breaking a rule only if terrorism is defined. It's fighting a person or a thing that's not defined yet. So it's not breaking a rule and it's getting away with that. So I think the root thing to be done is trying to make clear what is it that they're fighting and what is it that is the rule and what is it that's being broken. Unless that's not clearly defined, I'm sure our philosopher prof over there would be interested in a very abstract thing as that. It's a clear line that needs to be drawn. The crosser of that line would be clear, visible. Nobody's crossing any line right now. And this keeps on happening. Like you said, going on and on and on.
Well, you're right about it. And it's not only terrorism. There are a number of other things that need to be defined. Both John and Michael talked about a war of aggression, which is what we've participated in Afghanistan. It's what happened in Iraq. Have been called the supreme international crime in the Nuremberg Tribunal. And yet there is no official accepted definition at the moment of crime of aggression. If you look into the International Criminal Court and the Rome statutes that founded it, it was set up to look at, as I recall, correct me if I'm wrong, four major kinds of crime: crime of genocide, crimes against humanity, war crimes, and the crime of aggression, or a war of aggression. And the first three are cooking along okay, but strange to say, the major powers and those that control the United Nations have been unable to come up with a definition of war of aggression. Isn't that strange and that peculiar that they haven't been able to come up with a good definition? And therefore, it's difficult to nail them when they do what are obviously wars of aggression. So this idea of getting some of these key terms and insisting not only that they be defined, but that the definitions then be accepted by these bodies is very important.
Well, I thought that was very good, the policy shell game that's going on, which not only enables you to direct your attack on anybody, because this is a blanket term that can just be applied to anyone, you're quite right at that, but you also emphasize that it's something that automatically vindicates what you're doing, because there's nothing defined that you can break. So it not only is usable against the other, but it is automatically justifies what you're doing because there isn't any meaning to it. And that is really an Orwellian situation or a totalitarian situation where you just basically declare meaning by fiat, and if they disagree with you, they're terrorists, but if you attack innocents, then you're representing the free world and so forth. So we really do need criteria, and I think what Graham just said is so true. I mean, it's just so poignantly true that here we have the worst problem we've got going on, which is the supreme crime. And it isn't just the Nuremberg. The Nuremberg Charter has transitivity into international laws that now exists and into our own criminal code. We have crimes against humanity defined in our criminal code, and they're quite clear on what those crimes are. But with respect to the one that is the leader of all the rest, because that's also part of international law, the reason it's called the supreme crime because all the other crimes follow from it. And so the thing that starts it all, the supreme crime, is the one thing that isn't defined. And it's really quite monstrous. And then the terrorism, when you think of it, the word terrorism came from the French Revolution, and that was an instrument of government. An instrument of government against people that declared, you know, we all know the story of the French Revolution. But suddenly the word terrorist has been inverted so that it's now used by the government. They now just use the word terrorism to apply what's against the government in the same way that we use the word to apply to the government. And indeed, now it's the meaning of terrorism means that it isn't a government applying it. So we have this process of why I said Orwellian is a double thing that's built right into the whole process of perception and the normalization of crime as acceptable. And I think you're quite right that it really does go down to these criteria. I mean, what is terrorism? In fact, the operation that most intrigues me about this whole process is that you project onto the enemy what you are doing yourself as your justification for attacking it. That's it again and again. So when they use the word terrorist, if you say, well, what terror really means, let's just look at the dictionary. It's going to give us a good criterion, and we'll be able to work out a philosophical criterion that applies to all. But certainly it involves causing great fear in other people of loss of limb or life or something precious to them. We do cause enormous fear by terror of what's going to be lost, your limb and your well-being and your relations and so forth. So what are they doing all along in Afghanistan? They are creating a huge fear. Indeed, the whole that war criminal act against Iraq was shock and awe. It was they were advertising beforehand, this is an act of supreme terror. Shock and awe. And it's mostly against innocent people, like the 500,000 children that have been killed through the process of deliberately destroying life infrastructures of the public and so on. So you have an extra twist here. You not only have a double think going on, but you have the other being attacked on account of doing what you yourself are doing. And that just seems to be a closed circle of operation that goes on and on and on.
Yeah,
but I couldn't help just following up on one thing John said, which was the 500,000 children killed in Iraq. I keep trying to think, and this is before the invasion, of course, of 2003. This was through the so-called sanctions. I keep thinking of what it would be like if some country in the Middle East did this to, let's say, Canada, killed 500,000 children. A few years ago, several of us wrote an article. You can find it in the journal Medicine and Conflict, on precisely the conscious destruction of the water treatment facilities of Iraq. This was not collateral damage or accidental or anything. There is a formerly classified document, which I was quite shocked to read, which was produced in January 1991, just before the invasion of 91, and just after some months of sanctions against Iraq, called Iraq Water Treatment Vulnerabilities, which goes in detail into the Iraqi water supply and treatment system. It says the sanctions are already degrading it. It names the epidemic diseases that can be expected to come about. It talks about how Iraq does not have the equipment to repair its own system, and that we can expect the system to degrade further if things continue as follows. Now, we know that the UK and the US received that study in January 1991. What did they do after that? They prevented for a decade the repair of Iraq's water treatment facilities. They even targeted them during the invasion, the bombing of 1991, as well as targeting the hydroelectric stations crucial to that water supply. So those 500,000 children, many of whom died from diarrheal diseases that were preventable and that would have been prevented under Iraq's quite good water supply and treatment system previously, were killed consciously. Not as don't accept the stuff that they were collateral damage. This was known about, it's bragged about in at least one U.S. military document. He doesn't mention the children, but he talks with great joy about public health catastrophe, which was successfully created in Iraq. Now, I ask you to think about what would be said if that were done to children in Canada. You know, you have to be able to put that hat on and think about what would be said about that as an act of terrorism.
And again, you've been listening to a presentation at the University of Lethbridge, Canada, with four Canadian professors, Graham McQueen, John McMurtry, Anthony Hall, and Michael Kiefer. Tune in next week to hear the final part of this panel discussion. And now I want to remind you that architect Richard Gage, the founder of Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth, has already begun a 30-city tour. It's called the Expert Speak Out 2012 Tour, and he'll be stopping at Town Hall in West Hartford on Sunday, June 17th at 7 p.m. to show his film, Expert Speak Out, the final edition, and to answer questions and have a little discussion with the audience. So please get your tickets and come to that event, especially if you're a person who is in doubt or if you think we're crazy, because he's got the science. He's got the backing of currently 1,698 other architects and engineers who have examined the evidence that they have gathered over the last 10 years that contradicts what the government has told us. So these guys are not crazy people. They are 1,698 architects and engineers who are putting their reputation on the line to say, hey, we've been lied to and we need to take a look at this. So I encourage you to get your tickets, and you can get them by going to the website 911expertspeakout.org. That's 911expertspeakout.org. Or by going to the website ae911truth.org, or you can also get them at the door. And again, that's Sunday, June 17th at 7 p.m. in the West Hartford Town Hall Auditorium, 50 South Main Street. This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.